From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've been looking at America's growing unemployment crisis from a lot of angles, including the personal ones. On Monday, we caught up with News and Notes listener James Smith about his job search struggle.
The work I find here, they're saying I'm overqualified. What work there is being offered, and other people just aren't responding at all. So I'm finding it almost impossible to find a job. So I'm kind of gearing up to leave.
He's talking about trying to find work overseas, but we're going to dig today into what works when it comes to finding work. Joining us now, we've got Marshawn Evans. She's a founding member of the African-American job search website, amightyriver.com. Welcome.
Thank you, Farai. Great to be here.
So we just heard a little bit of our interview with James Smith. There are a lot of people out there looking. So what are the main issues that you're finding as you, from a professional standpoint, look at the issues facing job seekers?
Well, James Smith's situation is actually very common right now. I think one of the biggest challenges and one of the most common trends that we're seeing first and foremost when someone loses a job or is in transition is emotional despair. There's a lot of anxiety about being able to secure alternative employment and just dealing with the shock of being laid off. And so what's really important is that individuals have access to quality resources to re-enter the job search arena and really accessing pockets of growth, because there is hiring taking place. We really just have to connect people like James to the places where opportunity is happening. And sites like amightyriver.com are wonderful resources for African Americans. We're finding that over 200 to 300 jobs a day are being landed on our site. And just this morning, we found that there were over 40,000 jobs available in the top 15 categories being searched. So there are opportunities out there.
So why would you target a search site specifically for African Americans? Why do you think that it's important to be specific about that?
Well, there's a certain affinity that's created when it comes to community-based networking. And when I say community-based networking, you're talking about giving something before you look to receive. And the common approach to networking is looking to receive something before you get it. And so when you look at a community of African Americans who are there to support and help each other, you're creating an authentic network. And what people have today, I think, are primarily unauthentic networks or just mere associations. And so having a site like Amighty River, where you've got a community of African-American professionals there for one common purpose, to share resources, to share information, is critical. And it's also more effective, because if you find out about a job opportunity through word of mouth, you're more likely to be considered for that job, more likely to have a greater rate of return. And so that's a resource that African Americans have not been using in terms of being online doing that. But it's critical if we're going to stay competitive in this economy.
All right. Well, we've got someone who definitely wants to stay competitive. Tony Rice is based in New Orleans, works in hospitality and tourism, but looking to relocate to Houston. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. So tell me a little bit about your situation. What are you looking for? When are you moving? Why are you moving?
I am looking to relocate to Houston. My husband was transferred, and I am looking to stay within the hospitality and tourism industry and hopefully find something in Houston within the next 2 to 3 months. So I've started my job search, just kind of getting out leads, networking, and talking to people in the industry, trying to find out what's available in that area.
Are you in Houston already, or are you still in New Orleans?
Okay. I'm still in New Orleans.
So you're facing the issue of trying to do a remote job search, where you are looking for jobs in a city where you're not living. And let me go back and ask Marshawn about this. When you're not living in the same city that you want to find a job in, what are the special challenges, and how do you try to bridge those?
Well, the first thing is, a lot of times people think it's a disadvantage not to be local. And I don't think that's a challenge as much so as people might think, given the advent of the internet and the advances that we have with Web 2.0 technology. Because what you can do now is essentially create a virtual network before you're ever even in your new city. And you can start to create very meaningful relationships before you get there. As an entrepreneur, I'm constantly looking to establish new opportunities in different cities. And I usually try to figure out my marketplace before I enter. And so what I would suggest for Tony is to connect with the hospitality associations in the Houston area. Try to meet virtually online or via phone calls with the leadership of those associations. They're going to have access to some of the top jobs in that area within your industry, and you can start to create a very, very solid network that way. And the second thing that I would suggest is to interview some of the top professionals in your industry in that market. Say, you know what, I would like to schedule maybe 10 to 15 minutes of your time. I'll send you 2 to 3 questions via email so you know what I'm interested in talking about. And just say, you know, I'm trying to learn about the industry in this market and what the opportunities are, and you're starting to establish yourself in a different capacity.
Tony, you're in an industry that has taken some hits. Hospitality and tourism are down, and in some cases very significantly, like Las Vegas. So why are you choosing to stay in this field, and would you consider other ones?
First of all, I really enjoy tourism and hospitality. It's what I've done for the past 15 to 20 years, and I have a lot of experience. So my first choice would be to stay in that industry. Of course, I would consider another industry if I'm not successful in the hospitality industry. But yes, a lot of cities, they've taken huge hits. New Orleans is no different. They're moving more to online conferencing and more regional conferencing. So the industry has taken a huge hit. But there are a lot of opportunities in that industry as well. What I find in this industry, in particular, it's a very closed industry. Meaning that a lot of times the opportunities are not posted online, or they're only circulated in-house. That's where networking comes in and why it's so important, because there may be a position available that will not be put out to the general public, but it's just word of mouth, and people can tell you about positions that are actually in that industry or in that particular hotel. So my first thing is to get out into network. I'm finding that one of the particular websites, Almighty River, is very helpful in allowing me to do that, because you're going to have people on there that are necessarily that could be in that industry and just pass on a lead to me that may not be available to the general public.
Marshawn, you know, your site is heavily focused on not just job listings, but also social networking. But social networking on the biggest scale, something like Facebook, is not necessarily something that monetizes well. From your own standpoint, as a business owner, are you afraid that the business you're in itself is unstable, creating a web-based site like the one you have?
I actually think web-based businesses are going to be the areas that continue to grow and continue to thrive. And that's where jobs are secure. That's where employers go to hire, and that's where people need to be to find the best jobs. At Almighty River, there are hundreds of thousands of six-figure jobs that are available as of even today. There are, as I mentioned earlier, 200 to 300 jobs that we're seeing landed per day. There were over approximately 40,000 that were available, and people aren't necessarily aware of sites like Almighty River. It's key to understand that this is a site targeted towards African-American professionals. So there are top companies that are looking to hire top African-American talent, which makes it very different from the other social networking websites that are out there. Almighty River is a professional networking website. It is more than just a job board, and the job board is dynamic. It's powered by Monster, who has one of the most dynamic technologies in the world for matching employers with qualified talent. But it also has a community basis as well, where people can informally post job opportunities, informally talk about opportunities that they're looking for. So if you're looking for something in hospitality or in marketing, you can post. You say, you know what, I just lost my job, or I'm transitioning to a new industry. Here's what I'm looking to do. And instantly, and I mean instantly, you will have a community of people who will come to support you at Almighty River.
Tony, when you think about the best things that you have on your side, it sounds like experience is one of them, that you have a long history of experience in this industry. Do you think that experience is what it used to be? And the reason I'm asking that is because a lot of people are facing moments now where they've put in, say, you know, in one case, someone I know, 24 years in a company, and now having to face a change. Are you worried that even with your experience, that may not be enough?
Yeah, at times I am. Experience, you're absolutely right. It doesn't carry as much weight as it used to. But in certain industries, experience is crucial. And luckily, I mean, tourism and hospitality is one of those industries to kind of know your product and how to sell your product, how to cater to your clients. So that is, it's going to be important. But no, I'm finding that experience doesn't carry as much weight as it used to.
What does your husband think about your situation where, you know, he's already had to move on and you are trying your best to find the job that will allow you to move? Is he concerned?
He's not necessarily concerned, but of course, he's keeping his ears open and his eyes open and building his network along with my network and just putting feelers out there to see what's available in the community.
Marshawn, do you have tools that help people market themselves online if they don't necessarily know how to craft the right resume? And just briefly.
Yes, there are resources available for that. If you have a resume that's not up to date or you're not necessarily sure how to present yourself best with your resume, you can post that and you will have, we do have resources to help you tailor and make your resume as strong as it can be. And just real quickly on this point of experience, being different or having experience is not enough today. You have to establish what value you're adding. And what I would suggest for Toni is to take a look at her experiences and how they add value in this economy, in this marketplace.
Well, it was great talking to both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Marshawn Evans. She's the co-founder of the job search website, amightyriver.com. Also speaking with Toni Rice, a job seeker currently in New Orleans, but relocating to Houston, Texas. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Last night in Oakland, California, protests over the shooting of an unarmed man turned violent. Demonstrators smashed storefronts and cars, set cars on fire, and blocked streets over the death of 22-year-old Oscar Grant III. Early New Year's Day, Grant was traveling home on Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART, the commuter train system there. Grant and a group of friends were stopped by transit police for an alleged altercation. People nearby used their cell phones to video the incident. The videos show a police officer shooting Grant as he laid face down on the ground. Here to give us more on the case, we've got Bob Butler. He's a freelance Bay Area reporter for KCBS Radio and the Chauncey Bailey Project. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Farai.
So when you think about this recent trend of really moving towards violent protest, what does it say about the level of emotion over this?
Well, I think people are very angry in the Bay Area about what happened to Mr. Grant, and rightfully so. I mean, as reporters, we tend to be more impartial and not want to take sides on this. But when you see somebody, when you see the video and you see the young man was lying there, and it didn't seem to me like he was resisting. He was lying on the ground, face down, with his hands restrained behind him. And for some reason, the officer reached for his weapon and shot the young man. And so you understand why people are very unhappy and why they're very emotional about it. And this protest last night started off as a peaceful march from the Fruitvale BART station, that's where the shooting took place, down to the BART headquarters, which is about, you know, maybe a couple of miles away. And for some reason, and I hate to say this, but a lot of times you get a very peaceful march, and they get some people who join in, and things get out of hand, and that's what happened last night.
Let's go to the specifics of this case. Can you tell us a little bit about Oscar Grant, just a little bit about who he was as a person?
As far as I know, he was a young man. He had just had a baby. By all accounts, from, of course, talking to family, very responsible, loving person, but the family always says that. But the reality is he and a bunch of other of his friends have been out New Year's Eve celebrating, we believe, in San Francisco. On the way back home, there's some altercation started on the train where you get a bunch of young men together and two different groups, and, you know, we don't know if any blows were thrown, but people were concerned enough where they notified the train operator, and the train operator called BART police, and they met the train at this Fruitvale station. At that point, the police went aboard the train and pulled the people who were identified as being involved in the altercation out and began, you know, putting them on the ground, restraining their hands behind them, in some cases handcuffing them. And that's where the shooting took place. I mean, you know, I don't know enough about Oscar Grant to tell you that he didn't deserve this kind of thing. I don't know that, but it's pretty clear. Even if he had been fighting somebody, you know, to be shot in the back while you're lying on the ground restrained, it's just unconscionable.
We're going to hear shortly from attorney John Burris, who's filed a $25 million lawsuit on behalf of Grant's family. But what are the next legal steps from a criminal standpoint, if any, that we see ahead?
Well, my understanding is that the Bart Police Department is trying to investigate, and they were going to be able to interview Officer Maresley. But yesterday, when they were supposed to have a meeting in order for him to give his side of what happened, his attorney showed up and basically handed his letter of resignation, so he quit the force. So now they cannot compel him to talk to BART police investigators about what happened. Now, Mayor Ron Dellums of Oakland wants the Oakland Police Department to take over the investigation, and I've been talking to many officers in the department because of my other work with the Chauncey Bailey Project, and one of them mentioned to me that he would not be surprised if Oakland's homicide unit took over the case. So that seems to be the next step. As far as the lawsuit, John can talk about that, but I'm pretty sure that's well on its way.
All right. Well, Bob, thank you.
Thanks for Ryan. Good talking to you, always.
That was Bob Butler. He's a freelance Bay Area reporter for KCBS Radio and the Chauncey Bailey Project. Joining me now to continue this conversation is John Burris. He's the attorney representing Oscar Grant III's mother, Wanda Johnson, and Sophia Mesa, the mother of Grant's four-year-old daughter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So you filed a claim against Bay Area Rapid Transit Police on behalf of Oscar Grant's mother and the mother of his child. So can you summarize the claim, what you're asking for?
Yes, I filed this claim, which is a prerequisite to filing a lawsuit. And what I'm saying in that lawsuit is that he was the victim of excessive force. It's an intentional wrongful death. I'm seeking money damages in the amount of $25 million. It is our position that the officer, without justification, fired a bullet into the lower back of Mr. Grant while he was sprawled eagled face down on the ground. It was unconscionable and never should have happened.
Does it help or hurt your claim that so much of this has been recorded in this very postmodern way by people who were just watching from nearby?
I think it helps. Helps immensely because a video and taping of it is better than the eye because memories fade and people see things from different perspectives. But the video cameras, all the ones that have been taken, all give a clear, not clear, but give certainly an indication, a reflection of what happened. So from my point of view, the cameras themselves are the best evidence of what happened that night. We do have testimony from other individuals who give statements that corroborate what's on the tapes. But, you know, over time, memories can fade, and the videotapes never fade.
Are you concerned that the officer in the case has not been asked to make a formal statement yet or pressed to make a formal statement by his supervisors? And do you know why he hasn't been questioned?
Well, I am concerned, number one. But number two, he resigned yesterday, and he resigned because he didn't want to make a statement. An officer is obligated to make a statement if requested, but if he doesn't make that statement, then he has to resign. So the officer chose to resign instead of giving a statement, and he did that because he didn't want to waive his Fifth Amendment rights. That is, he didn't want to have statements made that he has made that can be used against him in a criminal case. So it was strategic on his part not to give the statement. It's actually unconscionable on the part of BART police not to have demanded that he declare that he wasn't going to give a statement at the very outset as opposed to waiting a week later, because I think what happened is he saw all the videotapes, he saw what people heard what people had to say, and he basically concluded that he could not come up with a story that would make him free of his acts.
The claim specifies that Grant was handled by a Latino officer. Now, do you think that race was a part of this?
Well, I don't think the race was a factor in terms of the shooting of this Mr. Grant. There was racial aspects to me in terms of how they were approached and manhandled at the very outset. And so the initial grabbing and handcuffing to me and how they were treated, that was more racially motivated in large measure because people use racial slurs. The N-word was directed at one more of them. They tell them what they were going to do, and they did it and couched it with racial derogatory terms. So it's hard to deny that race wasn't on the mindset of the officers involved. I can't say that he shot the person because he was black, but certainly the initial conduct directed in the manner in which they were manhandled, I certainly thought was racially motivated.
So BART authorities have 45 days to respond to the lawsuit. What happens next?
Well, what happens next is that there's a lot of activity going on. We're pressing that charges be filed against him. I have made a request of the district attorney's office for that to occur. There's a lot of public discourse taking place here with various rallies that are occurring. There's a meeting with the BART board this morning. So politically and socially, there's a lot of activity taking place. From a legal point of view, I'm just continually grabbing witnesses. I've had more witnesses come forward in the last couple of days. People who are outraged by this, people who are not even living in this country who were on the train that night, have called me and expressed their outrage. So from a legal point of view, that process has gone forward. We hope now that the district attorney's office will, in fact, prosecute, issue a warrant for this person's arrest, because if they do not do so immediately, the person is a flight risk. He could, in fact, leave the area, leave the state, leave the country, and there's nothing anyone can do about it until an arrest warrant is issued.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
That was Attorney John Burris. He's filed a claim on behalf of Oscar Grant's family. Grant was shot and killed by a Bay Area Rapid Transit police officer early New Year's Day. We also reached out to the Bay Area Rapid Transit Authority for a response. Representatives were unable to comment on the show, but sent us a written statement by BART Police Chief Gary G. He wrote, "I want to assure Mr. Grant's family and the public that we are taking this investigation very seriously, and we're committed to complete an unbiased and thorough investigation into what happened on the morning of New Year's Day. In addition to our investigation, we are fully cooperating with the Alameda County District Attorney's Office, which is conducting a parallel and independent investigation. We are providing all of the evidence of our investigation to the district attorney. As frustrating as it is, I want to stress that we cannot and will not jeopardize this case by discussing details before the investigation is complete." That was Bay Area Rapid Transit Authority Police Chief Gary G. The overall U.S. crime rate has been dropping steadily since the early 90s, but some caution that tough economic times could drive crime rates back up. When it comes to white-collar crime, are punishments too lax? An old saying goes, some will rob you with a six-gun, some with a fountain pen. We're going to take a deeper look at what crime is, how it's tracked and punished, in a month-long series launching today. Here to give us the big picture, we've got Franklin Zimmering. He's the William G. Simon Professor of Law at UC Berkeley and the author of The Great American Crime Decline. Welcome to News and Notes.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. I have to ask this basic question. How do you define crime?
Well, the basic question has one short answer and then gets a little more complicated. The short answer is that anything that a legislature says, a lawgiver says is a crime, is a crime. But when you go behind that and then you say, yeah, but what's the difference between the ways in which the law defines things as crime and the other ways that states regulate, what makes the criminal part of governmental power special is that the state gets into the business of first of all, trying to prohibit rather than regulate behavior, and then secondly, punishing people, making them hurt deliberately if they violate the law. So we try and get people to discourage, you know, to smoke less and to drink less alcohol because we tax it and we allow only adults to drink it. Those are methods of regulation. But with cocaine and marijuana, we pass a criminal law and we say, you really can't do it at all. And if you do, we're going to harm you deliberately to back up our intention to prohibit.
Well, let me ask you about the topic of your book, The Great American Crime Decline. You mentioned drug crimes and, you know, how drugs are differentiated, alcohol being a drug, but legal, of course. But we have talked a lot on our show about particularly drug crimes and how they have helped the prison system, you know, expand in terms of the number of people. But you're saying that crime itself has been going down.
Well, again, crime itself is everything that the legislature says is criminal. But if you restrict it to the sort of conventional street crimes that most people are worried about, and that 75% of those are nonviolent crimes against property, theft and burglary and auto theft, the other 25% are violent crimes. And during the period from 1991 to about 2000, all over this country, crime declined and declined quite substantially by about a third. So there was, in that decade, the 1990s, a drop that was unprecedented in its length and just about as large as we've had in 20th century American history. That stopped as a national pattern in about the year 2000. And what happened then was that crime stayed flat at its nearly low levels. And then in the middle of this new decade, around 2004, what happened is crime rates went up in some places but continued going down in New York City and were flat in most other places. So we now have a somewhat less robust trend to discuss. The good news is that we're still much closer to the low levels of 2000.
Mm-hmm. Let me jump in here because we don't have too much time left, and I want to be sure and ask you about what other systems do about crimes that we consider common, whether or not that fear is overstated. But when you talk about the kind of punishment that is given out for a drug crime or even a crime against a person, is there a great difference between how the U.S. system tends to treat these crimes versus other countries?
If you take a look at the punishments that modern states have to invoke, there isn't a difference in terms of the variety of punishments that are available. Prison is at the top of the things that we can do. It's the most serious, and it's also incapacitative. Everything else, fines, compulsory service, the blaming people, is considered much less drastic. And the big difference between the United States and other developed countries is not that we have different kinds of punishments, but that we use the severe punishments much more. The imprisonment rate in the United States is five or six times the imprisonment rate in other developed countries that we like to compare ourselves to. Now, people say, well, that's because our crime rates are higher. And that turns out not to be the case, that for almost all kinds of criminal behavior, certainly crimes against property and even low-level violence, the amazing thing when you look at transnational comparisons is that most of the developed countries in the world are in the same boat, have roughly similar crime rates.
Okay.
Where the U.S. stands out is in life-threatening violence. There, while we have rates which are lower than some non-developed areas, they're much higher than the Europeans and the Canadians and the Australians.
Well, Professor, we have to wrap up here, but thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We were speaking with Franklin Zimmering. He's the William G. Simon Professor of Law at UC Berkeley and the author of The Great American Crime Decline. He joined us from the studios of UC Berkeley. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. The name Bernie Madoff has become synonymous with investor fraud. He's currently in the spotlight for an alleged Ponzi scheme that bilked investors out of billions. But this is hardly the first time questions about white-collar crime have made headlines. You remember Enron, right? That was the energy company that cooked the books back in the late 90s. Before Enron, you had Michael Milken of junk bond fame in the 80s. Alan Sloan is now going to help us take a closer look at white-collar crime. He's senior editor at large with Fortune magazine. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So take us back to 2001 when the Enron scandal broke. What had the company hidden and how did it come to light?
The company had hidden the fact that it was making up most of its earnings, and rather than having solid profits, as it reported, it was actually losing money. And the way this came to light was that some people at the Wall Street Journal had trouble understanding what the company was doing, started raising questions about it, and then the Securities and Exchange Commission, which I suspect reads the Wall Street Journal very closely, began looking into it, and then the whole thing just sort of blew up and exploded.
There are a few names that, we remember from this case. Give me an example of a couple of the folks who, a lot of folks said that the hubris was amazing, not, you know, when people were finally identified. So who were some of the key players in this?
Right. Some of the key players were a fellow named Jeffrey Skilling, who used to be the number two guy at the place, was convicted, sent away for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, and is now appealing his sentence. The other big name was a fellow named Ken Lay, who was convicted but died before his appeal was finished. So I guess he died a criminal, or at least a convicted one. So those are the two big names that everybody remembers.
What do you think we should make of the punishments? I mean, now I'm going to talk a little bit more about the Madoff case in a second, but now people are looking at what is an appropriate punishment for someone who commits white-collar crime. Is this something that financial reporters like you take a close look at?
Yeah, and a lot of it is random. The thing that bothers me, sort of, is that once you're in the criminal justice system, it becomes a lottery. And if you have a good lawyer and your luck runs, you may get off with probation. If you're somebody like this guy Bernie Ebers at WorldCom, who's and that was another massive fraud, he got, I believe, 25 years. So you never know how it's going to turn out. And even if it turns out you're innocent, unless you happen to be a zillionaire and can afford enormous legal fees, to be indicted is to have your life over. I mean, that's my problem with it. I think the real guilty people should go away forever and a day and be branded with the mark of Cain and be an example to others. It's just the system is so random it bothers me. But then again, I'm not a lawyer.
It also seems that some cases get a lot of scrutiny while others don't get very much. And one of the ones that is getting a lot of scrutiny right now, of course, is the Madoff case, the alleged Ponzi scheme that may have bilked people out of billions of dollars. Of course, you know, a lot of the figures are funny, so we don't know quite how many billions. But when you look at this case and how it's playing out in the media, do you think that people really understand the implications of it from a financial standpoint and what it might mean for how much other fraud has gone on over the past few years?
Well, this is one of the things where nobody's really clear what's going on, and many of the numbers being thrown around, as you sort of implied a minute ago, come from Madoff and therefore can't be believed because nothing he says can be believed. But unlike, say, Enron, which was a real company with real employees and real people, it just had problems telling the truth. It looks like Madoff may have invented everything and never have actually made any of the investments he said he was making. So unlike, say, when Enron went down and dragged down a whole lot of other people, Madoff may well disappear without serious financial consequences, except for the poor victims. And as for the question of who gets scrutinized, it's fascinating. There's now an enormous case going on in Minneapolis, I'll bet you've never heard of a fellow named Tom Petters.
I have not heard of it.
See? He's been convicted of a variety of things that seem to have scammed billions of dollars from hedge funds and many people in the Twin Cities who trusted him, and much of the Madoff thing is kinship because a lot, you know, Madoff is Jewish and a lot of Jews were in there, But this fellow was some sort of evangelical Christian, or is, I guess, and he got a lot of evangelical Christians. This happened. I've been around 40 years, and I've seen it over and over again that people frequently scam their own communities because that's where they're trusted, and people don't do their homework on people they trust.
Now, in both the Enron case and the Madoff situation, they're very different in some ways, but they both benefited, at least for a time, from the fact that a lot of people don't understand finance, and it's very difficult to understand. What do you think people need to do who are not financiers to understand? Why is it important to even understand the issue of finance, white-collar crime, and all of these?
Well, white-collar crime matters because it affects all of us. Even if you happen to be a blue-collar person, you undoubtedly get affected one way or another. Your investments, your company, your suppliers, your neighbors, everyone gets affected by serious white-collar crime. And the old joke is, right, you walk into a bank with a gun, steal $50,000, they send you away for 10 years. You steal $50 million in some sort of white-collar crime thing, and you get, you know, 5 minutes and a warning from the judge. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but that's the kind of thing that for years has annoyed people, including me. And somehow because there's been now so much of the stuff has surfaced, and there's such conscientiousness about it, and in the case of Madoff, largely because he scammed people that members of the media know. So you get really angry when your friends go down. I mean, I don't have any friends who were in there, but a lot of people in my business have friends, and so you get really upset when you see your friends ripped off, and that's a big factor in the Madoff coverage.
All right. Well, Alan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That was Alan Sloan, Senior Editor-at-Large with Fortune Magazine. It's time now for a look at the week in sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farah. You know, it's all about football this week, college and pro. And here to bring us up to speed on what's important to look for this weekend is News and Notes gridiron guru, New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Mr. Bill.
Happy New Year, the great Tony Cox.
Happy New Year to you, Mr. Roden. You know, the big sports news today, of course, is the BCS championship game between the Florida Gators and the Oklahoma Sooners. But you know what? A lot of folks, me included, are not so sure that whoever wins that game deserves to be the national champion because there are some other teams, Bill, that are legitimate contenders, Utah, USC, even Texas. Do you think the outcome of this game really answers the question about who is best in college football?
No, no, no. A million times no, Tony. We are on the same page on this. I think it's bogus. It's a bogus system. The game tonight is okay. It's a waste of time. How could you be a fan of college football and look at a game in which USC is not involved? I mean, it's you know, it's really bizarre, and like I said, it's bogus, Tony.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to another topic. Here are two things that are not normally spoken about in the same breath: college football and interracial marriage. But those two things are now linked in a story out of the University of Florida, where the Gators' defensive coordinator, Charlie Strong, who was African-American, says he is not getting head coaching jobs because his wife is white. I'm not sure what to say about that, to be honest with you, Bill. It's one of those things you can't prove, but he's certainly convinced of it, and he is not alone. Charles Barkley recently charging that it was race that kept a black candidate from getting the head coaching job at Auburn. What do you say?
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, anytime you look at the terrain of college football and see there are only like four or five head football coaches, race, well, it's not so much race, but racism is alive and well. Now, it's because this guy's wife is white. I mean, if he feels that way, then it's, you know, at least he thinks it's legitimate. I think it's far more pervasive. I mean, sometimes if your wife is white, they'll hire even quicker. It's, this guy's safe.
I guess you never know, do you?
No, but I think that racism is a tremendous problem, and why it is could be your wife is white, or could be because, you know, it could be millions of reasons, but we've got to eradicate the cause.
Well, listen, we talked about coaches and the wives that they choose. How about coaches and their son-in-law? Detroit News sports columnist Rob Parker resigning after asking the wrong question at a news conference. A couple of weeks ago, he asked Detroit Lions coach Rod Marinelli if he wished his daughter had married a better defensive coordinator. Now, Marinelli's son-in-law coached the defense of the worst team in the history of the NFL, of course. The Lions went 0-16, but Marinelli did not like the question, nor did Parker's bosses, who demoted him. Parker says it was a joke, but it looks like the joke's on him.
Yes, unfortunately. I mean, Rob is a very good friend of mine. I've known Rob for years, and I think it's unfortunate. And I think what we have here is clearly there's been bad blood between, you know, Rob and the paper, because their stupid questions are asked every single day. All you got to do is look at the Sports Center. So I think that there's something deeply rooted. And I guess what's troublesome for me, Tony, is that we've just got a terrible track record of African Americans in the media, and period. If you go to a sports press box during the football season, during the baseball season, it seems like you're in 1955. And so I think that's the larger problem. We've lost another African American journalist in a field we could least afford it.
Well, you're absolutely right. Although Parker has a record of saying things that can get him in hot water in a number of places where he has worked before, we'll see what happens. Let's move on to another topic, though. This time of the season, all eyes are on the playoffs. But in your column in the New York Times this week, you suggest that the players should be concerned a lot more about selecting a new executive director for the NFL Players Association. Why, briefly, is this so important, and what's at stake?
Tony, outside of the NFL commissioner's job, the executive directorship of the NFL Players Association is the most significant and powerful job in the National Football League. And I think too many players are sort of sleeping on this. You know, Gene Upshaw was the president for more than 20 years, and this is the first time there's going to be a really legitimate election. And players really need to be aware of this, because this is an important position, it's an important job, and negotiations on a collective bargaining agreement are coming up. So they really have to wake up and, you know, not be so involved in football that they miss it.
Well, it's hard not to be involved in football, your point notwithstanding, particularly with the weekend of games coming up this weekend: Baltimore at Tennessee, Arizona at Carolina, San Diego at Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia at New York. And for my money, Bill Roden, this is the game to watch this Sunday, particularly Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb. Just when we thought he was going to be run out of town on a rail, he's brought the team back. They're in the playoffs. Fans love him, but he's got to win for them to continue that love, doesn't he?
Got to win, and I don't know, Tony. I'm in New York and all that, but I think Philadelphia is very hot, and McNabb is really hot, and this brother's got a lot to prove, and he wants to prove it.
But what about Andy Reid? Is he on the hot seat too? If they don't go all the way,
you know, I think they were both on a hot seat, and now miraculously, you know, pro football, if you win, they, like you said, they love you. I think Andy Reid just may be tired. I may be tired of all the flip flopping, but. You know, this franchise will not be the same when Reed and McNabb are not there, and those fans better savor what they've got.
All right. We've got about 50 seconds. I'm going to give you three really quick topics. We're going to run through them quickly. Number one, Boston College actually fired its head football coach this week after warning him not to interview for a job with the New York Jets. He did, and they did. That's cold, isn't it?
The Jets are cursed, man. Even if you just they got somebody fired, and not even a coach
just
yet.
interviewing him. The Dallas Cowboys are still licking their wounds from another disappointing season, but they won't have Adam Pac-Man Jones anymore. They cut him loose. So is he done with the NFL now?
He may be. He may. You know what? He'll end up with the Jets too.
Another L.A. Sparks WNBA player is turning from dunks to diapers. First star Lisa Leslie left to have a baby. Now league MVP Candace Parker is pregnant. Her status for the season unclear. What's going on in the NBA? Wait, don't answer that. Thanks, Bill. Bill Roden, a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback, joining us from our New York studios.
And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How's it going?
I am fabulous. So what are we hearing from listeners this week?
Well, people are still filling our inbox about the show's cancellation. We got a few letters from people who were glad to see us go, but the support we're hearing from our fans is pretty amazing. This week, we're going to focus on people who listen to news and notes from different parts of the globe.
First up is Christopher Yeary, who wrote to us from Tokyo. I would like to say how disappointed I am over the news of your show going off the air. I am African American, and days go by without seeing anyone else that looks like me. And there's rarely a chance here to discuss issues relevant to the African American community. News and Notes filled that void, but for now, Gambate from Tokyo, Japan.
Then Virginia Carlston in Rome, Italy, sent us this. I have been living abroad for the past 4 years and have downloaded your podcast daily as my means of keeping up with what is going on back in the States. I'm a 30-year-old white woman from Atlanta living in Rome, Italy. I hope that everyone at News and Notes will continue the good work, even if it's not on NPR.
We now head down under to Brisbane, Australia, where Scott Ferris sent us this. Australians, not just Americans, value this program, which delivers quality in journalism and depth of coverage that is hard to find. If you take it off the air, I will simply listen to NPR less.
Then Clark Arrington chimed in from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He wrote, I am an African American living in Tanzania and totally rely on Fry and crew through podcasts to keep me informed about what is going on in the U.S. and the world for that matter. However, Fry is much more than a female African American voice. She is an informed progressive and an insightful mind.
And finally, we go to a fan in Saudi Arabia. Ibrahim Sadiq heard a rebroadcast of a conversation we had on Latin jazz and sent us this. I wish to thank News and Notes for the excellent program on Latin jazz, as well as the month-long treatment on jazz. I currently live in Saudi Arabia and enjoy News and Notes, which is rebroadcast during my morning commute. It provides a refreshing entry for the morning. I hope that the coming months will bring about a turnaround in the U.S. economy that will allow kaleidoscopic programs such as News and Notes to remain on air.
And that's it for letters, so wherever you are, please keep your thoughts coming over the next few months.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, police all over the country say shoplifting is going up, just one symptom of our times. We continue our crime series with a look at how lawlessness affects society's bottom line.